good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about how the fat file system works. We mentioned, well, we had talked about how directories contain lists of files and information about them, but we also needed to find the root directory. And also some other information about the file system, like how big did we decide clusters were, where exactly is that file allocation table, and we decided we'd have a header just near the beginning of the disk for that. We also mentioned we had to figure out where free space was when we were making files, and in fact they chose we're going to use the file allocation table for that too. It'll just have a special value that marks free space because we don't have a next cluster for free space, just free. Then we started talking about sort of hardware. So how do hard disks work? We mentioned concerns that we have when we're using them. So one was that we had to worry about seek times, that because hard disks are these physical things that are spinning and the data is stored at different places on the spinning disk, how long it takes us to get to the right parts by moving our head, which is reading over that disk, and that disk moving to get the right, as we said, part of the cylinder over the head, that can affect our performance. We mentioned that, well, if we have multiple things to read, we have to be careful about ordering when we read them. Or if we, well, either operating systems or the disk controllers themselves, because we have these queues of requests, and the disk controller actually has a lot of smarts in it. And some of that smarts is that if the OS gives it multiple requests, it figures out what order to do them in. And the other part of that is that it also deals with the disk failing, because disks fail a lot, but they fail way more if the disk controller didn't hide some little failures by copying data to some place that hadn't failed. Then we talked about solid-state disks. So solid-state disks, we're using this completely different storage technology to provide the same interface as hard drives. And they run into this problem that, well, this storage technology, these flash chips, don't actually have the same kind of characteristics that hard drives have. And the most important way is that we have this idea of erasure blocks, that we can only erase relatively large chunks of data at once, much larger than operating systems that used hard drives were used to overwriting at a time. We had to erase before we could write again, unlike with hard drives. And we also have this concern that we can only erase things a certain number of times before it starts failing. So we wanted to spread out the load so that failure would happen in a very long time, even though we might, from the operating system's point of view, be writing to the same part of the SSD over and over again. That can't actually happen. And our solution for this was this idea of block remapping, that every time we did a write, we choose a new location on the flash, and we maintain this table of the locations the OS thinks it's writing to and the real locations. And we'd also use updating this table to handle when we wanted to erase a whole block, we'd move everything in that block somewhere else to free up some space that we could write to again. And we just started talking about, well, a different file system design. We're going to start looking at that in more detail and think about, like, not only just how it is different from FAT, but also, like, how these decisions might be good or bad for how disks actually work. So before I move on with that, any questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so we were talking about the XV6 file system, and the XV6 file system, unlike that, we didn't just have this one structure. We have our header, which they call a super block, just a different name. Like with the FAT file system, it tells us where things are. So in particular, it tells you where each of these things start, because they store the block number in there. And we had our file information in this new structure called an inode array. So we store the information for every file together in the FAT file system. This information was kind of scattered around. We had our type of file was stored in the directory entry, and we had the first block of the file stored in the directory entry, and the remaining blocks of the file we had to look up in the FAT. In the inode system, all the blocks of the file are stored in one location. We also have the size of the file in the FAT file system that was stored in the directory entry here. It's stored file. And we have some other information here. Remember, we talked about devices having a number. Well, that's where that number is stored if it's a device, which we know by the type. And we also have this thing called endlink, which I'll talk about a bit later. So something which isn't stored in this inode structure for a file is the actual name of the file. And that's going to work the same way as it does in FAT. We're going to have directory entries. So our directory entries are going to contain a name and just an inode number. So rather than having all that extra information, we just have an index into our array of inodes. So we also have to represent some other information that was in the FAT, that is what blocks are free. And XV6's choice is that we just choose a place on disk that's going to contain an array with 0 and 1, depending on whether the block is free or not, array of bits. And for inodes, we need to know how to allocate an inode. The choice in XV6 is they just use a special value of type for inodes which aren't allocated, and they scan that whole list. Some other file systems which use a similar design might have another map of array of bits to make that easier to look up. Okay. So since XV6 is not just a file system format, but has an actual implementation, there are some things where with FAT where we talked about you had options. Like we said, you went to make a new file, you have options about where you put it. But in XV6, well, they have to make a choice. So like they could put it in any set of free blocks, but their choice is when they need a new inode or a new data block, they just take the first one that's free. So they scan for data blocks that list of free, that array of is this block free, to find the first thing that's free. For inodes, they scan the array of inodes until they find one that isn't used. Okay. Now, one thing you might have noticed here, if when we look at our inode structure, that we have an array of data blocks, and this is great for files which have less than whatever n direct plus 1 blocks is, but it seems like a problem because it seems like we've really limited our file size. That we bothered using a 4-byte unsigned integer to store our file size. Okay. But yet, we can't seem to actually use values which are larger than that. Apparently, my screen is frozen. That is wonderful. Okay. I see. Okay. Well, that. Okay. So we are going to. Okay. So it seems like if we take more blocks than that, we have a problem. So what we're going to do to deal with that is that we're going to have a scheme that allows some indirection. So notice the thing here is called ndirect plus 1. So we have that number, which happens to be 11, or 12 rather, 12 direct blocks. So those are just pointers to blocks. And by a pointer to a block, I mean, well, actually what we're storing here is we're storing the index of the block. Index on disk. So zero-based. And we won't actually use zero because that's where the superblock is. That's where the header is. So, but we also have an indirect block. So we have one of these blocks doesn't point to data, but it points to more block numbers, more indexes, and that's where the rest are. So we can store, so for our first 512 bytes of the file, they're in this block. Then we have the next 512 bytes in this block, but we can keep going beyond the number that our number of pointers would seem to suggest because we have a whole block of extra pointers. And it happens that we have our pointers are 2 bytes. So here, this is going to be 256 2-byte pointers, which takes up 512 bytes. So it's exactly the same size as one of those data blocks, but we aren't putting data in it. We're putting pointers to other data. So this means that our file sizes aren't as limited as you might have worried. So we have our 12 direct blocks, and with those, we can point to about 6K of data. But with this indirect block, we can point to 256 extra blocks, which gives us about 128K more. So the total file size we support is that 6K for those first 12 direct pointers and 128K for that indirect pointer. So you might wonder, why do we arrive at this particular scheme? So what's an advantage of having, why do we bother having direct pointers? Why would we want to do that? Why don't we just have indirect pointers? You know, if we're going to have to do that anyways for a lot of files. Yeah. Speed. So what's the speed advantage?
I assume, like, since you don't have to, indirectly do it, you can just immediately go to disk.
Yeah, so you're saying one speed advantage of that, this is stored with the rest of the info for file. So we read this once, we're done. If we have the indirect pointers, we'd read the info for the file, and then we need to do another read to figure out what to read. So when everything fits in these direct pointers, that's a big gain. There's another big advantage to having these direct pointers. Yes. So you're worried about space at runtime?
Sure.
Okay. So that might be a concern. There's a space-related concern, which is more of an issue, which is space on disk. That if our file is not very big, we can fit it entirely in direct blocks. If we had to just use an indirect block for that, sure, I can fit the file in it, but I would be wasting most of the space in here. You know, this is, you know, if this was all nulls, then that's a lot of space that we're allocating on disk that's not useful. So in this way, by setting the number of direct blocks, we can say that small files we're not going to allocate extra space for. But large files, we might start waiting, we do that. But this means that small files, we don't allocate a whole extra block to store like a 6-block file, which would be what we'd have to do if we only had an indirect block or a couple indirect blocks. So that's why they've chosen this hybrid approach. And something that people have observed empirically is that most files are pretty small. So this is a CDF of file sizes people observed on like corporate real world workloads. And you can see that like most files, like over 70% of files they observed were less than 10 kilobytes. So that's a reason to have these direct blocks, that for those 10 kilobyte files, if we had a whole indirect block, that would be a lot of space that we probably don't need to be using. Okay. So this is an efficient scheme. You might say this maximum file size here, you know, that's okay for XV6, but probably you would not be happy with that file maximum file size on your desktop. You probably want to store things which are larger than 128 plus 6 kilobytes. So there is an extension to this scheme, and an example of an OS which uses this type of scheme is Linux. So Linux is, I'm going to talk about the extended two file system. If you use a recent version of Linux, you'll probably use, you might use extended four, which is just a newer version of this. And here's the inode structure, an excerpt of it, for extended two. So first, let's talk about some fields that aren't this list of blocks, but we'll talk about how this list of blocks gets stored, and we'll see that it has a more flexible scheme. But something to note is that there's a bunch of metadata files commonly have that we kind of haven't talked about. Some of it we have, which is like these times. We saw that in FAT, that FAT stored a bunch of modification and creation times. XV6 just doesn't have them, but if it did, they'd be in the inode. We also have the type information, so like in XV6, but we also encode in here whether other people can read it and so on, just in the same field, and who owns it. In XV6, there's no users, so they don't encode that, but here there's a user ID and a group ID to encode who's the owner of this file, along with the times. Then we have this pointer. So this is where the data is. And there's more indirection here because, well, Linux wants to support files that are not super small. So this is sort of what the picture looks like there. So we have our first level indirection like you saw here, but we also have schemes with more indirections. We have a bunch of block pointers. So we have 12 direct block pointers, just like XV6. Then we have an indirect pointer, just like XV6, that points to a block which contains all pointers. But sometimes that's not enough. And if that's not enough, we don't just want to add another indirect block because, you know, that doesn't scale very well. So we add a double indirect block. So we have a block which contains pointers to blocks of more pointers. And if that's still not enough, we have a triple indirect block. We have a block which contains pointers to blocks of pointers which contain pointers to blocks of pointers. And you'd imagine that if you decided that still wasn't enough, maybe you'd have a quadruple indirect block. So we have our direct pointers, indirect, what's called the double indirect pointer, and a triple indirect pointer. Questions about? Yes.
So what would be like the purpose of like making a triple indirect pointer or like a double indirect pointer?
So question is, why would we do triple or double indirect? The idea is that this supports big files reasonably well without adding too much to the inode. So each time we add indirection, we're making it support much, much bigger files, only adding one field to our inodes, which meaning that we aren't making small files much bigger. Other questions? Yeah.
Are the indirect pointers always at the bottom?
The question is, are the indirect pointers always at the bottom? This is the choice they have made, yes. They're always later in the array, so we don't use them. So the choice that we make is that the beginning of the file is always stored with direct pointers, and the ends of the file are stored with more and more indirect pointers. Yes?
In the triple indirect pointer, does it allocate all the blocks on disk?
Question, in the triple indirect pointer, does it allocate all the blocks on disk? That's a good question. So this pointer, not all these pointers from the first level pointer might be valid. So there might be some nulls, basically. And that's true for all the pointers here. So there might be a lot of nulls, especially if the file, you know, isn't as big as it could be. Yeah?
The speed trade-off that that we have with each indirect pointer that we add, then how much is it? Is it like, so whenever we're accessing a big file, is it going to affect our speed in terms of like each trick or whatever?
So the question is, does having this extra indirection make accessing the file slower? And the answer is, well, of course, because we have to read more. Like, we have to read strictly, we have to read more data in addition to the data in the file. So of course it's going to be slower. The advantage of this scheme is that we're only paying that extra cost on large files. And for that large files, we can perhaps like hide a lot of the cost because we're doing big reads anyways. And if we're reading a lot of data, maybe picking up an extra block along the way isn't a big deal, especially if it happens to be close on disk. Yeah?
What if your file's larger than 8
gigs? What if I have files larger than what?
8 gigabytes.
Why would you say 8 gigabytes? So if you do the math, so you're getting ahead of us. So every exercise, so it depends on the block size. So the question is, so you probably you thought it was 8 gig for 512 byte blocks, around 8 gig. Now, one thing which makes it not so bad is that typical file systems have bigger blocks than that. So let's say we have 1K blocks. In Extended 2, this is configurable. You can have 1K up to 4K or 8K even. So you have 1K blocks and 4-byte block pointers. 4-byte block pointers, because if we only have two, that might not be enough for a really big disk. How big can a file be with this scheme? I'll give you a minute to do that math. That's what it means.
Okay, wait.
Yes, this is 1 kilobyte blocks. Yeah. Yeah, sorry. This is 1 kilobyte size blocks, not 1,000 blocks.
Because that's my block point is put into a block, an indirect block.
Yeah, so I guess to start out, so for the direct pointers, we can store 1K of data, 1K blocks for each of those pointers, so that's 12K. For indirect pointer, with indirection, we point to 1,024 divided by 4 pointers, because that's what one block can contain, 1,024 bytes. every four of those bytes is a different pointer. So that ends up being 256 blocks we can point to. Each of those 256 blocks can contain 256 kilobytes of data from the file. And then for a double indirect pointer, so what do we do there? So we have 1k times how many blocks? How many blocks can we point to with that double indirect pointer? So, yes. So for figuring out that, so what I think about it, so we know that each block of block pointers can hold 256 pointers, just because of the sizes. So if we think our double indirect pointer, we have a pointer to a block, which has 256 things coming out of it, and that goes to another block, which has 256 things coming out of it, and this finally gets us to a piece of data. So we have 256 times 256 blocks of data that this can refer to. And in order to store that, it turned out that we used 1 plus 256 blocks of pointers. So that's some overhead. That doesn't store the file data, so it doesn't affect the file size. But yes, we in fact allocate an extra 127 block to 257 blocks on the disk just to point to data. Or point to blocks that point to data. And for the triple indirect, we'll get 1k times 256 times 256 times 256 again, just because we have another level of that, of this fan out. And to find the total file size, we add these all up, because we'll have these all happening at the same time in our big file before we run out of room. Questions on this procedure and or an approximate? I didn't actually do the arithmetic to figure out the simplified answer. Yeah.
1024.
The 1024 here. This is the size of a block from 1K of block, and this is the size of a block pointer. So it's the number of block pointers in a block.
And then that 1K multiplied by, that'd be 1024.
The 1K I'm multiplying by is, what? Sorry, which 1K?
The 1K times the...
Yeah, each block is 1K. So it's 1K, I guess, per block. And I counted the number of blocks we can point to. So we can point to 256 blocks, and it's 1k per block, so I got 256k through the indirect pointer. And here it's 1k per block, and I can point to 256 times 256 data blocks using my indirect block and my double indirect block and my 256 indirect blocks that it points to. And that gives me 1k times 256 squared. And then for the triple indirect block, I have 1k times 256 cubed. Because I have a triple indirect block pointing to 256 double indirect blocks, which collectively point to 256 squared indirect blocks.
So you use 1024 for one, and is it 1,000, or would it be 1024 if you wanted to find them?
Question the amount of bytes?
Yeah. Would it be 1,000 or would it be
Oh, sorry. The question is whether I'm using 1,000 or 1,024. In this class, when I use kilobyte, I always mean 1,024. I understand that this is not universally the rule, but I'm going to use it that way. And hard drives, when you act, so hard drives may advertise themselves with kilobytes being 1,000, but when you access them as sectors, it's always powers of 2. Other questions? Okay, so we saw indirect blocks. So, and this idea of having these arrays of block pointers. So a curious feature that this way of storing where the file's data is that there's something called sparse files. So we talked about, well, if the file doesn't take up all of the space that the double indirect block could point to, we'll just have a bunch of null pointers at the end of it. We can also have null pointers, it turns out, in the middle of files. So if I run this code on Linux, where I open a file, seek to the middle of the file, print there, and close it, usually this file will take up one block. And the way that's going to work is that there will be a bunch of block pointers that are null. There will be an indirect block pointer, which has a bunch of null pointers, and one actual pointer to 1 meg into the file. So when we're reading the file, we just look up which block pointer we want based on how many bytes are we in. If we're 1,024 bytes in, and we have 512 byte blocks, we want to go to pointer 2. So we just do that, and if they're pointers which are null, the convention that XV6 and extended 2 use is to just say, if you try to read them, they're all zeros. And we don't bother storing all zeros on disk. So, for example, in XV6, I could create a file where I, just wrote to random things in the middle of the file, and we just have a bunch of block pointers that don't point to anything. But we have just the data for the parts of the file which aren't zeros. And this brings to mind sort of a little bit of an advantage that the scheme has over FAT scheme, which is that even if we aren't doing the sparse files thing, maybe we don't care about that. There's good reasons not to care because it's not actually that useful. But we can just go to a particular byte in a file and we can quickly look up what's the block for that with this scheme. And we can even do that for blocks in here because we just know we can do the math to figure out which number would it end up being without like scanning through all the blocks beforehand. So this is an advantage of our indirect scheme, is that we can find a particular offset even if we have to go through several indirect pointers pretty fast, unlike the FAT scheme where we have to traverse this linked list. So when I talked about directory entries, I mentioned that directory entries contain a name and an inode number. And the inode contains all the non-name information. So an advantage of this scheme is that we can have multiple directory entries that refer to the same file. And this is, in fact, something that XV6 and Linux, most Linux file systems support. So each directory entry in this scheme is called a hard link. You can have multiple hard links to the same file, and it just means there's two names that refer to the same file. And on Linux, you can, in fact, create hard links with the ln command. So here I create a file test.txt. I put text A in it. I make new.txt a hard link to the same file. And this means if I modify new.txt, it's the same file, so both of them get modified. It's the same file because we look up the directory entry for either one. We get the same item number. We get all the same block pointers and all that data. It's all the same. There's no actual difference. They're just different names. And this gets us to our mystery field that we sort of skipped over in our inode, which was that we had this nLink value. So that's the number of hard links to a file, because we have to know when do we actually remove the file. And the answer is when the number of hard links goes to zero, which may remind you of what you are trying to do for the paging protection homework with pages, but with files. Another trick that Unix-like systems do is they count, when you have the file open, they count it as a link. And this means that on Unix-like systems, you can create a file, open it, and delete it from the directory, but still have it open. And that's because the thing you have open is the inode, not the actual directory entry. And we can track that, oh, we have this many open copies and not delete the file too early. And this is, in fact, what Linux and XV6 would do. And this gets to what removing a file is. So on POSIX, the function to delete a file from a directory is called unlink. And now you know why. Because directory entries are hard link, unlink is unmaking a directory entry. So if you've used Unix-like systems a lot, you're probably more familiar with another type of link called soft or symbolic links. And these are links which don't actually have two directory entries that refer to the same inode, but we have one directory entry which has the name of something else. And here I make a link new.txt which points to test.txt, but it points to it by name, meaning that if I modify test.txt and create a new test.txt, even though that's a different file, it's going to use the name to find it, so it's going to actually check for a new different file with that name. Okay. Questions about this? And you might say, well, how is this implemented? So basically, this new.txt is just a special kind of directory entry, which rather than containing an item number, contains a name of something else. And the OS, when you open it or something, has to like look up that other name, and will in fact do that. Okay. So we're going to talk a bit about ways in which XV6 kind of did better. So there's one thing we'll talk about later, which is about reliability. So we saw that log is going to help us deal with crashes. We'll talk about how that works later. We mentioned that we have these free block maps rather than scanning a FAT, so that's more compact, so hopefully faster. And we mentioned that you can seek to a particular part of a file easier because we're storing these arrays and not a linked list. And that we had these tricks we could do because we decided we weren't going to split up the file information between directory entries and elsewhere, so we have all the information in one place, which makes it easier to deal with. So, right. We've gone through XV6. Before we're going to talk about ways in which XV6 is not so great, but before we do that, let's talk about... Let's do the same thing we did for FAT for XV6. So how many inodes and blocks does a directory of 230 kilobyte files take up? anyone can start me on this? So what's the first thing we want to figure out? Or any first thing we should figure out to answer that first question? Anyone? Yes.
How many blocks are required to store one file?
Okay, so number of blocks per file. Okay, so that's a good question. So we have 30 kilobyte files, and our blocks are half a kilobyte. So we need 60 blocks for the data. But we also need to store block pointers. And we know we only have 12 direct block pointers, so we're going to need to have a block of block pointers for the remainder after the first 12. So 60 blocks of data and one block of pointers. So we have 61 blocks per file. So the file data is going to be 61 times 200 for the files, blocks for the files. What else do we need to consider? After I figured out how I'm storing the data for those 200 files, what am I missing? What else do we need to store? No volunteers. It's helpfully written on the slide, except I misspelled it. So directory entries are another thing we have to store. So we need to store 200 directory entries. So 200 directory entries times 16 bytes per one is going to be 3,200 bytes of directory entries. And happily, 3,200 bytes of data fits in the direct pointers, so we don't need a pointer for the directory, but we do need, this is going to be seven blocks for the directory. So we have 61 times 200 for the files, plus 7 for the directory blocks, plus we have to allocate 200 inodes for the files, plus 1 inode for the directory, which is going to be in that separate part of disk. Remember, we store all the inodes together, separate from the data blocks, where data means data or block pointer arrays. Yes?
Can you say again why we need 200 inodes or one
inode? So 200 inodes for the 200 files.
Okay.
And we need one inode for the directory, which is also just a special file. Questions about this? So if we think of this second exercise here, we have 3 kilobyte files, that's 6 blocks, and that doesn't need any indirect pointers. But we have 2,000 times 16 bytes of directory entries, which is going to be 3,200 bytes of directory entries, and that's going to need an indirect pointer for the directory. So that's going to end up being, so this is going to be 3,200 is What? 32,000. Sorry, 32,000 is going to be. That's going to be about. That's going to be about 64 data blocks. 64 data blocks for the directory. Plus one block of pointers for the directory. So we end up with 2,000 times 6 plus this is the space for the 3K files, plus 64 plus 1 for the directory that contains them, blocks. This is the number of blocks. We also have some inodes, so we need one inode for each of the 2,000 files and an inode for the directory, just like before. So any questions on how I got these answers? Yeah.
How does the file system like adjust the indirect pointers and such as like the file gets?
The question is, how do we change the indirect pointers and such as the file gets bigger? Whenever we need to go to a part of the file which needs an indirect or double indirect pointer, which we just know by how far into the file it is. We allocate a block, just like we would allocate a data block, but we store pointers in it. And we have a way of representing null pointers, so when we allocate that block, we just fill it with pointers to nothing, null pointers, basically. And we update those as we write data blocks that are that far into the file. Other questions? Okay. So XV6 does some things which aren't great. So one thing that's not great is the inode data and the block map data is stored in one part of the disk, and the file data is stored elsewhere. And if we think about seek times, this seems bad. That if we're like reading through a directory, we need to read the inodes for the directory on one part of the disk, and all the data for the files, this might be in a, you know, much further into the disk. We also have this choice of file and directory blocks, which seems inelegant, of choosing the first thing that's free, when really we want to make sure that files and directories are close together. So there might be a better scheme which avoids this, and we'll talk about that. Another issue is I had to choose block sizes. And with 512 byte blocks, you found out we were using lots of blocks to store just pointers. We can kind of mitigate that by making our blocks bigger, but then we're wasting space for small files. Like if I have 1 kilobyte blocks and I'm storing 100 byte files, well, too bad, you have to use a kilobyte for it, each of those files. And also, we still have our directory entries. If we have 2,000 directory entries, we're going to need to read all 2,000 of them to determine that, no, that file name you entered is not valid. So there's a file system which solves the first two problems, which extended 2 is based on. So we'll start talking about that. And it solves both the block data being stored far away and this unintelligent choice of blocks. And the way it does this is it divides up the whole disk into kind of mini subdisks. So it uses what they call block groups. So they split the disk into block groups, and each block group is laid out kind of like the whole file system was, but kind of in miniature. So we have each block group has their own free map, indicating which blocks are available to allocate, their own inode array, and their own data. And our idea is that we're going to try to allocate directories within a single block group. So we're going to have all its inodes and its data in there. And this is going to be how we're going to keep data close together on disk and not have to seek all over, like when we're reading a directory, to read the inodes and read the data. And also, we're going to use this to take advantage of trying to keep data for one file together, because when we try to place blocks for the file, we're not going to take the first thing that's free. We're going to choose a block group we want to put the file in. Now, we still want to have the same basic scheme as we had with our overall file system where we have inode numbers and block numbers. So what we'll do for that is we'll divide up the inode and block numbers between the block groups. And we're not going to actually stop it from being the case that some directory stored here has a directory entry giving inode number 1027. And we're not going to stop it being the case that an inode stored here points to a data block stored over here. So that's still going to be allowed. We're just going to usually prevent that from happening. But we're going to have the flexibility to have files that span multiple block groups or directories and so on, if necessary. And what we're going to try to do is we're going to just try to say each directory we're going to assign to a block group, and we're going to try to put all the files in that directory in a block group. And we're going to use this heuristic that when we have a new directory that we're making, we're going to make it choose a new block group for it. So we're going to try to store each directory in the same area of the disk to lower these seek times. Of course, if we have a very large file, well, of course it's going to be split across block groups. But that's okay, because it's a large file, and we can hide a lot of the seek time because we're just going to be doing these big reads. Now, we're going to say, okay, so I know I want to assign a file to a particular block group. How am I going to do allocation? So the FFS, the fast file system, its arrangement was you choose a block group, and then you take the first blocks which are free. And you might say, gosh, that doesn't seem very good. But it turns out that this works out pretty well. And the reason it works out pretty well is that usually you have a structure like this in your block, and as long as there's free space, you'll have a few like discontiguous blocks you'll allocate, and then you'll allocate a big section if the file's big enough. So it turns out you'll end up having your files be almost contiguous in practice. This is not always true. You could imagine sequences of creating and deleting files, which would make this really not work out very well. But it's usually true, especially if you don't use all the space. And something that FFS deliberately decided to do is they said, we're never going to fill the disk. We're going to leave at least 10% of it free so we don't have problems with having little holes to fill it. So the basic scheme is we divide our disk into block groups. When we make a subdirectory, we choose a block group for it. All the files try to stay in the same block group as their directory. We stay at the first free block, but we have it underutilized, so there's usually a bunch of free blocks at the end of each block group, so we end up with mostly contiguous allocations. They also use this trick that, well, if we're writing a file and we have a page cache, the naive thing to do would be, once I allocate space in the file, I choose where it is on disk. But you don't need to do that. You can wait until you actually need to write dirty data back. And this means that if an application writes 1 megabyte over like a half a second, you can wait until after that half a second and figure out, oh, I need to allocate 1 megabyte and make it more likely that that one megabyte is in one place. Whereas if you did it while it was writing, maybe two files were being written and you have them interleaved. But you can avoid that by just trying to allocate all the file at once if it's written all at once. Okay, so questions on block groups? Okay. So I said, fast file system is the like academic file system that introduced this, and extended to sort of follows the same approach. So another thing that the fast file system dealt with is this issue of wasting space for small files. So the fast file system wanted to use bigger blocks, but they realized that using bigger blocks is a kind of a problem. So, for example, if you want to go all the way up to 1 kilobyte in, well, at least in 2000, which is when this paper is from, then you'll end up, you know, in some many systems, half of your files are smaller than that. So you're wasting space by allocating a whole block for like a half kilobyte file and many thousands of half kilobyte files, it turns out. But you still want to have your blocks be, you know, not 512 bytes, because that means for these big files up here, which they're not many of, but they take up a lot of space, you're storing less block pointers. So FFS decided to make this compromise that usually we allocate whole blocks, but we have an exception case. And that's, we divide these blocks up into what are called fragments. So they take each block and you split it in four, and you say the last block of a file can be a fragment. And in that case, you can store with four fragments per block, four files all together in one block if they're small. And you only do this for the last block, so you still have block pointers where each block pointer gives you a whole block of data. So for large files, you're taking up, you're using, each pointer represents more data, but for really small files, you make sure that you don't waste all that extra space in the block that was too big to hold the file. And the way they did this is they just said, well, fragments have indices. The indices are just the block index times 4 plus however far into the block you are. And we have just a field in the inode which says, is the last block a fragment or not? If it's true, you interpret it as a fragment. Otherwise, you get the whole block. Interpret it as a whole block. So questions on this idea? This is just a way of dealing with, well, we don't always want a block. There's a relatively simple scheme to deal with it. Now, a challenge that will come up is that we need to actually allocate fragments. So this means that we actually need to store free information on a per fragment basis. And they just said, okay, we're going to make our free map four times as big, no big deal. Okay, and this is something that, again, extended to copies a bit. Copies to do, because we still have the problem of small files. So there's some things that the fast file system doesn't do, and that, therefore, extended to doesn't do, but are commonly supported in file systems like NTFS, or its derivatives, which are sort of what Microsoft uses, or extended 4, which is the sort of modern version of extended 2 with extra features. And one part of this is a solution to the other half of this problem about block sizes. So we wanted bigger block sizes so we had less block pointers. But for really big files, even if we make the block size pretty big, we still have lots of block pointers. Like if we're storing 100 megabyte or gigabyte files, we want our block sizes to be like 16 or 32K to like have less pointers. But if we do that, it seems ridiculously bad for smaller files. So is there some sort of compromise? And a solution that was used, that's commonly used, is that we say, well, why are we storing arrays of block pointers anyways? There's something better we can do for most files. And the idea here is to store instead extents. So rather than storing the list of blocks, we try really hard to allocate contiguous blocks. And rather than storing, one, two, three, four, eight, nine, 10, 11, we store one, four blocks and eight, four blocks. So we try to get mostly contiguous blocks and we store a list of the ranges. In this case, I'm storing start block and size. We could also store start and end block, same thing. But we store that instead of an array. So this, from a point of view of solving that problem, seems like it solves the problem, except how do we do this effectively? So what are some things that we've made harder by using this way of storing files? Yeah?
Is there a cache?
So gaps meaning?
Like index, the previous example, we had something
cases. Okay, so we can't do, so sparse files seem harder here. Okay. There's more common cases which seem harder. They're solvable, but it seems like we might end up with bad answers. So one thing to think about is when I showed you what we were happy with for allocating blocks before, if we think about what happened here, that we allocate a few little chunks and it's not contiguous, like previously, this wasn't a big deal. Like, so we skip over a few things when reading the disk, it's not going to affect much, we have to get the list of block numbers anyways. But now, with extents, that's a problem, because we really want to find contiguous sets of blocks without any gaps in the middle of them to allocate to the file, which means we can't use that nice simple find the first available block algorithm and expect good results. Like, it will work, but then we'll have a giant list of extents rather than something that actually is smaller than the block pointers we were storing. So, challenge for this, you have to do some other strategy. So, to give a concrete example, NTFS uses extents. They have a free block map, and they scan over a lot of the block map to find the hole in the block map, which is as close to the size of the file without going under as possible. So that's a lot more complicated to do. And of course, sometimes there won't be a hole that big. In that case, they divide the file up into more than one extent. But this is a lot more complicated, but maybe it's worth it. It's probably worth it, actually, if you think about big files. So the other question was about holes. And there's a secondary issue related to that, which is that if we have a list of extents, how do we find out where in the file a particular byte is? It looks like here, I want to figure out where does block 6, I need to read through this list in order. So we're back to where we were with FAT, where we have to like traverse a list to figure out how to seek to, you know, 1 meg into the file. We need to traverse this list of extents. Hopefully it's very short and that's not a problem, but if it's long, it seems like that would be very expensive. Now, it turns out extended 4 has a solution to this problem, and that they deal with long lists of extents. So can someone tell me how would I make, you know, what would be a scheme to, you know, make it so I don't have to go through that giant list to figure out where a particular index is? And this will also solve our sparse file problem. But one solution to this, yeah.
So that's at the top, you have the biggest file. So you know, for like those particular like extents, that it's gonna take more time, so it'll take less time to find.
So you're saying you have to get my setup. I'm saying one file just has a big list of extents in it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You're talking about how do I find a free set, and that's also a great problem that we could do better than a block map. It turns out most file systems don't, but yes. Yeah.
You can know how much each, like if you had 1, 2, 3, 4, and it was like 1 and 4, you could know how much each block, how many bytes it had in each one, and then you could just go to the number of times, however big that block is.
So I agree. So the problem we want to solve is that you're saying we know that it was the size of each. So I agree we'd like have that. The issue is that they might not be all the same size. You know. So if I have like this, how do I figure out that 27 is the thing that is, this is sort of start and size, that if I went to go 12 blocks into the file, it's 27. It's the third extent, not the second. Yeah.
You could change the size to be like how far into the file you are. So it would be like 1, 4, and then 11, 12.
Right. So you're saying that we could change the... size to be how far in the file we are. Well, that doesn't quite help us, but we could add how far in the file we are. I agree. So we could add, you know, 4, 4. Here we're 8 and 12 bytes into the file, 12 blocks into the file. How does that help us find things?
Because then you can just multiply however far you are into the file by 512 to get the number of bytes in.
Yeah, so we can figure out, so we know how far we are into the file. So the question is, we're searching this list, what can we do? So one thing we can do is a binary search. We can just look in the middle of the list and say, is this the byte I want? So that's the first part of the approach. So we can do a binary search. And there's another variant of this, which is should be reminiscent of that, is that we can store a tree. And this is what extended 4 is chosen to do. So we store a search tree, where the keys for the tree are how far into the file we are. And we can look up in that a particular index and do it. Now, for extents, this actually doesn't seem worthwhile, assuming we can make the list of extents long. Like, you know, maybe this shouldn't happen, right? Maybe we should have a list of extents which is like 2 entries, right? Hopefully, if we aren't using all the space in our disk, we can find a big contiguous area of our disk and not have to do this. But this idea of storing a tree is actually really helpful for something else, and that's going to be for, you know, directories. So directories, our key is going to be the file name, and we want to look up the directory entry, and a tree is exactly the sort of structure we want for that. But since we're on disk, we're going to have to store our trees a little differently than what you're used to from 2150. So what's the biggest problem with storing trees, with 2150 trees as far as how disks work? Why would that not be effective if we just used that unchanged on disk? We're like, made an AVL tree on disk. What's the problem? So we could absolutely do it, but it would be very inefficient relative to how efficient we could be. What's the main efficiency concern if we think about taking an AVL tree and storing it on disk? Yeah.
It could be like rectification. So like if you delete, for example, like bytes that are in the middle of the file, then everything would need to be shifted around and the tree itself would be shifted as well. So like that would take time.
So if we're storing a tree, then we don't, storing a tree, then presumably you're saying, I'm worried that we'll have to move things. So if we're storing a tree, presumably these are pointers. So if we delete this node, we just mark it that block as free.
Although if it were an AVL tree, you would try to keep it balanced.
Yes, so if we're an AVL tree, you're saying we try to keep it balanced, and what would that mean?
That means you'd have to do rotations, and you have to keep track of all the values, and then it would take time to do the rotations, like go all the way back up to the root node.
Yeah, so you're saying we have to do rotations, and this means that we're going to have to read a whole lot of things. So an observation is that if we have like an AVL tree, this is actually going to be a lot of accesses for this. Because if we think about a binary search tree, you know, if a binary search tree, like an AVL tree, this is about log n deep, log 2 of n deep. And that turns out to be a lot of disk accesses. Another problem is that the minimum amount we can read and write on disk is a sector. So if it's a binary search tree, then each of these nodes is one sector. So 512 bytes. That is way bigger than a directory entry. So it seems like either we have to like squeeze multiple things in one sector and squeeze multiple nodes in one sector and deal with like reading back the rest of the node, or this is, you know, or make our waste a lot of space. So there's an alternative, which is commonly used when we're storing data on disk, which is a non-binary search tree, a balanced non-binary search tree. So rather than each node having 2 children, each node has several children. And the idea is that each of these nodes, you know, choose the number of entries and children based on the block size. So Since we have a fixed size block that we want to write on disk, we can make our tree as fat as makes that useful. And here, I have the keys of my tree. So I'm saying I have 7 here. And it points to this because all the things that are less than 7 are in here. Everything between 7 and 16 is in here, and so on. And each of these nodes contains a little array, but that's fine because we're going to have to overwrite the whole node all at once anyways, because that's how the disk works. So even if we want to insert something, you know, in the middle of here, that's not a big deal because we have to rewrite everything anyways. Okay. So this is, you know, this sort of scheme that modern file systems use to store things like directories. So they don't have to search a directory with like 2,000 files linearly. They can store it this way. And also, you can make it so you can update only a little piece of the directory and still be able to efficiently like search for a particular name. Okay. Some questions about this idea? Yeah.
Would each of these be 512?
So each of these questions, how big would each of these be? So they'd be at least 512. So you'd make it at least as large as your sector. You might make it larger than that, because we know reading more than one sector at a time is fast.
So if you wanted to add another block to this, would you change the array at the top, or would you just add it?
So the question is, if I wanted to add, so what do you want me to add to this?
Like if one of them filled up, so I guess like 3 or
so. If I wanted to add 3, then there are, so like with AVL trees, there are schemes for balancing this. I'm not actually sure what those schemes would do, but one option would be, if I wanted to add 3, is that I could add a new node here. Do that. Another option would be I could do some sort of rotation thing where I like move an element up from 5 up into there or something like that, and split things up. We're not going to go into the actual algorithms for managing this, other than to say they're kind of like AVL trees, but extended. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So, yeah, that's, so we see we use these trees to find things on disk. So, and this is like a neat solution to that problem. So we solved some problems there. We looked at all these problems. So we also solved our linear searches of directory entries with a, you know, binary search tree. We have extents, so we can have one pointer that points to a bunch of blocks altogether. That's our extent, rather than just one pointer for each block. We have pointers to fragments of blocks to handle really small files. And we have this idea of block groups to keep data for related files together and data for a file in one place. So we solved a bunch of these performance problems. So our next topic, which we'll talk about next time, is going to be about reliability in file systems. So if I have a crash, what's the state of my file system? So that's what we're going to get into next time. And so far, we kind of just glossed over that entirely. And this is obviously something you actually really care about. And this is where we're going to get into that log that XV6 has.